Well, welcome again to everyone to the third and final lecture in this year's series. When we've been considering the various responses of faithful Christians in the late 16th and early 17th centuries to the problem of a Church of England that was insufficiently reformed, but which increasingly demanded conformity to practices that they considered unbiblical. And the key question for all of God's people was, what is a true church? Was the Church of England, with all its remaining corruptions, a true church? And in the face of rising persecution, should God's people stay in that church, or should they go? And all of the people that we've been looking at sought to find an answer from the scriptures to this dilemma. And there was no single right answer to the problems they faced, and no one group had the monopoly of truth. And all of the different groups have contributed much to our rich spiritual heritage in terms of theology, ecclesiology, their doctrine of the church, and faithfulness to God in circumstances of great adversity. We stand today on the shoulders of all of them. In lecture one, we looked at those like Arthur Hildersham who felt that they had no choice but to stay within the Church of England, which they believed remained a true church as long as it had two things: gospel preaching and the proper administration of the sacraments. In the second lecture, we considered those who decided to emigrate to New England in order to worship in accordance with their consciences. Francis Higginson, John Cotton, and others who went stressed that they weren't separating from the Church of England, but in practice, when they got to America, they developed a congregational form of worship. Tonight's lecture, covering just the same period as the other two, roughly 1580 to about 1620, will focus on a third option: those who elected to separate from the Church of England. Now, I did think about calling this lecture Chexit, Church Exit. It's just about as complicated as that process. Well, these people are these separatists who actively chose to separate as a matter of principle. They did it because they didn't believe that the Church of England was a true church. And of course, after 1662, all nonconformists were forced out of the national church, but that's another story. So here's the outline of tonight's lecture. We're going to start with a general introduction to separatism, what they believed and who they were. And then we're going to work chronologically through the decades, looking at some of the main separatist leaders in each decade. We'll start with the 1580s and a man called Robert Brown. And then in the 1590s, we'll concentrate on two men, Robert Barrow and John Greenwood. The next section, which will cover the 1590s to the 1600s, will concentrate on Francis Johnson. And this is a kind of bridge between what had gone before Robert Brown and Barrow and Greenwood, and then John Smythe, who came after him. Then we'll look at John Smythe himself, which will be the 1600s and 1610s. And then a very brief conclusion, four lessons that I've learned from studying these separatists. So first of all, then, a general introduction to separatism. And I want to start with a few caveats about the content of this lecture. And I'm sorry that there won't be much directly about Leicestershire tonight. I could only find a couple of tantalising references that related to early separatists in the county. But Leicestershire did become a major centre of nonconformity from the mid-17th century onwards. However, we'll have to settle for a wider East Midlands contribution tonight, which there will be. Secondly, I'm not going to be so foolish to attempt to cover the whole subject of nonconformity or dissent. It's much too big and complex a topic for one evening and for one person. And neither am I going to trace the history of individual denominations, such as Congregationalists or Baptists, since at this early period, things were much more fluid and they didn't settle into these organisations, denominations, till a bit later. Because as I've said, the religious situation between 1580 and 1620 was a very fluid one, with all of the major evangelical leaders engaging in passionate debate on the subject of the church, and opinions were constantly shifting and developing. Most of the separatists started off as zealous Puritans within the Church of England. Some of those who left were persuaded to rejoin the established church. Some of those who emigrated to New England returned to join separatist churches or parish churches. So there was a lot of movement in all directions. And we must beware of putting anachronistic labels onto people which they wouldn't recognise. But what I do intend to do tonight is merely to provide a few snapshots of key figures in the early story of separation in England, mostly during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and the decade following her death in 1603. And nonconformity really developed in the later 17th century, and the stories that, God willing, we will hear next year come from that period. So, what did these separatists believe? Separatists argued that a true church needed not only gospel preaching and proper sacraments, but a third feature, which was a proper church organisation and government in accordance with the New Testament pattern, led by pastors and elders chosen by each congregation of believers. And this third mark or characteristic, advocated by reformers like Martin Bucer, they called the discipline. And by this definition, the Church of England was not a true Church of Christ because it lacked this discipline. And a key passage for what these separatists believe was Matthew 18, verses 15 to 20 that Paul read earlier, and especially verse 20. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. And from this verse, they concluded that a church should be made up of a group of believers, or visible saints, as they called them, gathering together to worship God. Under the authority of their own chosen leaders, they would covenant together to worship God in a biblical manner. The unconverted were welcome to attend worship services, and their conversion was prayed for. But membership of the church and participation in the sacraments was reserved for those who openly professed faith in Christ. The separatists compared this pattern of church organisation that they saw in the New Testament to the Church of England of their time. A state church headed up by a hierarchy of a monarch and lordly bishops. Parish services consisting of a mixed body of believers and unbelievers, all repeating set prayers. This kind of inclusive church might cite the parable of the wheat and the tares, or the wheat and the weeds, in Matthew chapter 13, to justify Christians and non-Christians remaining together in the church until the end of the world. But, argued the separatists, in verse 38 of Matthew 13, Jesus clearly states that the field is the world, not the church. Well, listen to this summary by a preacher called John Wilkinson in 1619. The true visible Church of Christ under the gospel is the place of God's presence, which he hath chosen to put his name there. Where two or three or more are gathered together in the name of Christ, there is Christ present. And where Christ is present, There hath God put his name. There he is to be sought. And there he may be found, and there is his tabernacle. To come together in the name of Christ is when God's people join themselves together in a spiritual body politic, separated from the common multitudes of known unbelievers, to the end to meet together for the mutual edification and comfort one of another by doctrine, preaching, breaking of bread and prayer, and to practice all other ordinances of Christ set down in his testament, as they shall have occasion. And to companies of believers having such fellowship and communion one with another, the title of the churches of Christ doth properly and of right belong. Well, from these ideas was to develop the doctrine of the separation of church and state, or the doctrine of the two swords, as it was sometimes called, the civil sword and the spiritual sword. But the initial concern was for gathered churches and pure worship. So who were these first separatists? The majority of the early leaders were university men, fairly high in the social scale, who'd often been zealous church Puritans first. And their followers could be found amongst middle-ranking yeomen, tradespeople, skilled artisans, who were by and large literate. They weren't a rough, uneducated rabble, as they're sometimes portrayed. But they did become social outcasts, because any criticism of the monarch's role in church government was seen as dangerous sedition, a threat to the whole stability of the nation. And despite the separatist protestations of loyalty to the Queen in all civil matters, the full power of the state and church was rolled out against them. And tonight's story is one of imprisonment and exile. The separatists didn't get everything right. They were sometimes strident. But we shouldn't forget that they were in uncharted waters, working things out as they went along, often under enormous pressure. And those of us who belong to nonconformist or free churches, non-Anglican, owe these brave pioneers a huge debt for hammering out principles that are foundational to our way of worship and church government. So we're now going to look at the 1580s and the person of Robert Brown. Robert Brown was a bit of a maverick. Benjamin Brooke called him a very singular person. I don't think that was a compliment. And he's an important person because he was the first outright opponent of the national church in the Elizabethan period. An antagonist labelled him Troubled Church Brown. And all later separatists were abusively referred to as Brownists right up to the 1640s. There had been a few separatists in London in the 1560s, but it was Brown who gave the movement its title, with his articulate and energetic championing of the cause. And his ideas were the starting point for others who came after him. He had a long and eventful life, and in fact he outlived all the other separatist leaders that we'll look at tonight. Robert Brown was born around 1550 at Tolthorpe Hall in Rutland. And some of you I know have been there for its open-air Shakespeare productions. Brown wouldn't have seen any of those plays because he was born about 15 years before Shakespeare. But Shakespeare did derisively refer to Brownists in Twelfth Night. You can come and tell me the quote afterwards if you like. And Brown's family belonged to the landed gentry, with an ancient lineage, owning a lot of land and property around Stamford. And if you visited Stamford, you may have noticed Brown's hospital. They were almshouses in the centre of the town, which were founded by his family. And Brown also had connections to another Stamford notable, Lord Burleigh, Queen Elizabeth's Lord Chancellor, a very important man. Brown may have been converted during his time at Corpus Christi College in Cambridge. And in the late 1560s and early 1570s, Cambridge was a centre of fervent religious debate. And when Thomas Cartwright, the great Elizabethan Puritan reformer, was preaching a series from the Book of Acts on the early church, men ran like boys, so eager were they to get a place to hear him. And Brown was influenced by these so-called forward preachers, like Cartwright, who were dissatisfied with the lack of progress in church reformation. And in late 1578 or 1579, Brown lived with another forward minister called Richard Greenham at his household seminary in Dry Drayton near Cambridge. And Arthur Hildersham was another person who spent time there a few years later. And like in Luther's household, spiritual issues and how to deal with the corruptions that were so apparent in the church were freely discussed around Greenham's meal table. Well, Brown was forced to resign from his post as a schoolmaster when his new opinions brought him into conflict with the local minister. And it was sometime in 1579, when Brown was asked to preach at his old college, that he experienced a crisis of conscience. By this time, he concluded that the whole ecclesiastical system of the Church of England was unscriptural, with bishops usurping God's authority. So, by early 1580, Brown was coming to the revolutionary position that the church could not be reformed from within, as the majority of Puritans still hoped for, but that God's people, however few, should separate from an anti-Christian establishment and form their own little congregations. Brown resigned his Cambridge position and began to hold his own meetings or conventicles for worship. Church of England pulpits were now closed to Brown, and with his friend Robert Harrison, a native of Norfolk, he moved to Norwich, where conventicles were again formed. And gathered churches were planted in different places in East Anglia, which was already a centre for radical religious ideas coming over from the continent. Brown was arrested by Bishop Freke of Norwich in April 1581 for holding conventicles in private homes around Bury St Edmunds. Lord Burghley asked for him to be treated charitably. However, nothing deterred Brown, Harrison, and their followers soon decided to make a formal separation from the Church of England. They agreed, quotes, to join themselves to the Lord in one covenant and fellowship together, and to seek agreement under his laws and government. They also promised to avoid disorders and wickedness, obey those whom they chose to instruct them, and abide by procedures for teaching, warning, and rebuking each other. And their aim was to make one another, quotes, obedient to Christ, and to judge all things by the word of God. And these ideas reflected Brown's desire to create a new church according to a scriptural model. And Brown was chosen as its pastor, and Harrison as its teacher, his assistant. And what they'd done in forming this separate church was strictly illegal, and they soon found themselves persecuted by the church and the civil courts. And in the face of this, sometime between May and August 1582, the congregation emigrated to Middelburg in the Netherlands, where there was a measure of religious freedom. While there, in Middelburg, Brown published a volume containing three treatises defending and explaining his ideas, the most famous being entitled A Treatise of Reformation Without Tarrying for Any. In it, Brown addressed pastors in the Church of England, telling them that it was their responsibility to reform the church, not waiting or tarrying for the civil power or magistrate to do it. He said, the Lord's spiritual government can no way be executed by the civil sword. Christ alone had authority in his church. And Brown defended himself and his followers against charges that they were traitors to their queen and country, who'd forsaken the Church of God and brought the preachers of the gospel into contempt. But Brown declared the guiding principle in the church must be, quotes, "In all things we must first look what is the Lord's will and charge, and then what is the will of men. For we are bought with a price," says Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. "And we may not be servants to the unlawful commanding of men. And this freedom have all Christians, that they consider what is lawful and what is profitable, what they may do and what is expedient, and in no case be brought under the power of anything, as Paul teaches us. We hold our liberty. For if either magistrate or other would take that from us, we must not give place by yielding unto them. No, not for an hour. And this liberty is the free use of our callings and gifts, as we see most agreeing to the word of God and expedient for his glory." And Brown also said that true religion could not be forced by the civil power, through compelling church attendance by fines and coercion, which is what they did at the time. He said, "The Lord's kingdom is not by force, neither by an army or strength, as be the kingdoms of this world." And he went on, "In the meantime, let them know that the Lord's people are of a willing sort." That's fantastic, I think. "They shall come unto Zion and inquire the way to Jerusalem, not by force or compulsion, but with their faces thitherward. Yea, as the he-goats shall they be before the flock, for the haste they have unto Zion. And they themselves shall call for the covenant, saying, Come, and let us cleave fast unto the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall never be forgotten. For it is the conscience and not the power of man that will drive us to seek the Lord's kingdom. Yea, and the Lord's people shall come willingly in the day of his assemblies, even his armies in holy beauty." Very powerful words. The true church was God's holy people, and as such should be separated from the world. God would surely judge the wickedness of the Church of England, he said, where all were forced to attend, and ungodly folk hypocritically mouthed vain words from the prayer book in an outward show of religion, and hogs and dogs, as Brown called them, took communion alongside the faithful. Well, on the 30th of June 1583, a royal proclamation was issued in England declaring Brown's works to be, quotes, "seditious, schismatical, and erroneous libels, tending to the depraving of the ecclesiastical government established within this realm, revealing the malicious disposition of lewd and evil-disposed persons to be ready to violate and break the peace of the church, the realm, and the quietness of the Queen's people." And anyone owning, distributing, or reading Brown's banned books would face the severest penalties. And all copies were to be taken to the local bishop to be burnt. Later that same year, 1583, two men, John Coppin and Elias Thacker, were hanged at Bury St. Edmunds for distributing Brown's works, and 40 copies were burnt at the same time. This is a memorial erected in 1904 in the grounds of the Congregational Church in Bury St. Edmunds. Well, back in Middleburg, a pure and perfect church had been set up according to the New Testament model, with a biblical constitution and officers of its own choosing. What could possibly go wrong? The answer, of course, is that it was made up of people like me, and probably you, converted sinners. For just over a year later, the congregation was disintegrating, ravaged by bitter internal disagreements. And it's quite uncomfortable reading Brown's account of what happened, of how something begun with such idealistic hope could collapse so quickly. But it's the old story of church disharmony that's all too familiar to any of us who've been Christians for any length of time. And it's a salutary lesson for all of us. Brown put it like this. There fell out questions, offences, and taking of sides, as we know it hath always been in the Church of God. And when there's more than one church leader, there's always the potential danger of people preferring one over another, as the Apostle Paul found. And in Middleburg, a rift opened up between Brown and Harrison, when members apparently went behind Brown's back to Harrison with unsubstantiated accusations that Brown had called Harrison's wife a reprobate, and that he said she hadn't properly repented of sins that she committed in England. Brown later denied that he'd ever said this. But instead of following the church order that they'd agreed on, when the matter could properly be sorted out in a church meeting with Brown present, Harrison listened to these rumours and instantly jumped to his wife's defence. Brown wrote, "There was their whisperings, backbitings, and murmurings privately and amongst themselves. Also open grievous threats, taunts, reviling, and false accusations were rife in their mouths." 3 times Brown was thrown out and reinstated as pastor, and new slanders were raised, including a ludicrous one about the pawning of a silver spoon. It beats questions about what colour you should paint the walls, I suppose. But we shouldn't forget that the little congregation was under tremendous stress. They were living in grinding poverty, subsisting by working at the most menial jobs. They'd launched out on a completely new venture. Many of them were desperately homesick and wanted to return to England. Brown was certainly a strong leader. He had to have been, to have challenged the status quo so courageously. But perhaps he had been too heavy-handed or authoritarian in his exercise of church discipline. But for their part, perhaps the congregation should have been less ready to believe or spread bad things about him. So, late in 1583, Harrison took over as leader of the Middleburg Church and attempted to link it up with the non-separating English congregation in Antwerp, of which Thomas Cartwright was now minister. Brown, a broken man, left Middleburg for Scotland. He tried to join the Edinburgh Kirk, but they refused him on account of his unorthodox opinions and his arrogant manner. He then denounced the entire Scottish system of church discipline, so they briefly threw him into prison. Robert Brown spent the next 2 years, disillusioned and dispirited, travelling on the continent, corresponding with men like Thomas Cartwright, who urged him to reunite with the established church. But Brown's troubles were mounting, and doors were closing on him. And on his return to England in 1585, Brown was arrested because of his seditious writings. And worn down by religious disappointments, responsibilities for his large family, he had 8 or 9 children, and legal problems, Brown agreed to Lord Burghley's offer to intercede for him with Archbishop Whitgift. And on the 7th of October 1585, Brown signed a submission, acknowledging Whitgift's authority over him and accepting the Church of England as the Church of God. He promised to receive the sacraments and pledged to keep the peace of the church. Now, who knows whether Brown had really changed his mind about what he believed, or if he was simply ground down by circumstances. At any rate, this submission marked the end of Brown's open association with the separatist cause. But Brown's submission brought criticism from all sides. Other separatists quite naturally felt betrayed and thought that he'd sold out. Church Puritans accused him of cynical hypocrisy. Well, as a result of his submission, Brown was able to work for 2 years as a schoolmaster in Southwark before moving to Northamptonshire, where he had family connections. For 20 years, from 1591, he lived quietly as parish minister of Thorpe A Church. Brown's final 23 years, he lived to be over 80, were again marked by troubles after an unhappy second marriage and strife within the parish. Court cases and accusations of domestic violence led to the loss of his living and then imprisonment in August 1633. And Robert Brown died in Northampton Jail, and he was buried in St Giles's Church in the town on the 8th of October 1633, and there's a memorial plaque to him outside the church, which you can still see today. So it was a sad end to a long and controversial life, which continues to divide opinion. Was Brown a bold idealist, a cowardly turncoat, or a dangerous radical? His brave experiment failed, but he had set out on a path that others of his countrymen would follow. We move now into the 1590s. A decade of rising political tension, with a continuing Spanish threat in the wake of the Armada, and uncertainty about the royal succession as the childless Elizabeth grew older. And in the religious sphere, the atmosphere became more poisonous with the anonymous publication of the scurrilous Marprelate tracts, which mocked the church establishment. We're going to look briefly at the lives of two men, Henry Barrow and John Greenwood, who were the next major leaders of the separatists after Brown had recanted. Barrow and Greenwood shared many of Brown's views on the gathered church, but they were quick to distance themselves from the discredited former leader, and they hated it when their enemies labelled them as Brownists, for they'd engaged in many controversies with Brown after he had conformed. And we're going to focus on two aspects of their greatest influence, the pen and the prison. Barrow, in particular, was a prolific writer of polemical and apologetic works that had a profound impact. It's been said that, collectively, Barrow's and Greenwood's writings constitute the most comprehensive and consistent statement of Elizabethan separatist beliefs and principles. Well, Henry Barrow was born around the same time as Brown, and like him, into an affluent gentry family, in his case in Norfolk. His father, a JP, was reputed to hold strong Puritan convictions. In 1566, Barrow too proceeded to Cambridge University, but we don't know if he was acquainted with Brown at this time. After university, Barrow entered Gray's Inn in London in 1576, and for some years he was engaged with the legal profession. And he was converted as he heard the powerful voice of a preacher as he walked past a London church, and became, in his own words, a zealous professor of the gospel. Sometime after his conversion, Barrow returned to Norfolk, where he read Brown's writings with the intention of confuting them. But finding some passages, quote, too hard for him, he consulted an ordained minister called Thomas Wolsey, who became one of the leading separatists in East Anglia and who spent the last 30 years of his life in prison. And Barrow was only one of 20 zealous professors who espoused separatism under Wolsey's influence. And another association that Barrow formed in Norfolk was with a younger man, John Greenwood, a Cambridge graduate and ordained minister. Greenwood, too, read the writings of Brown. And by 1585, he'd resigned his curacy and become a separatist. Greenwood left Norfolk for London to worship in separatist conventicles. And on the 8th of October, 1587, Greenwood and 21 other separatists were arrested and committed to the Clink prison in Southwark. This is obviously a reconstruction of the conditions in the modern Clink Museum. And the Clink prison was one of the oldest and most notorious of prisons, with pretty horrible conditions in it. And the following November, Barrow travelled to visit his friend in the Clink. After they'd been together for about 15 minutes, the keeper of the prison arrested Barrow on the orders of Archbishop Whitgift, who'd been keeping a close eye on Barrow for some time. And when Barrow was summoned to appear before Whitgift, he refused to acknowledge the authority of the court and would not take the oath. According to Barrow, the Archbishop concluded the hearing by saying, "You shall not prattle here. Away with him. Clap him up close. Let no man come at him. I will make him tell another tale yet, ere I have done with him." And at a later court appearance, Barrow said of the Archbishop, perhaps a little unwisely, "He is a monster, a miserable compound. I know not what to make of him. He is neither ecclesiastical nor civil. Even that second beast spoken of in the Revelation." In May 1588, Greenwood and Barrow were indicted as recusants, and the legislation that was used to bring this charge was meant for Roman Catholics who refused to attend the Church of England, not separatists, but it was now applied to them. And they were transferred to the Fleet Prison. This is the ditch or sewer outside the prison. The conditions there were absolutely appalling, and Barrow and Greenwood spent years in the Fleet Prison, chained in disgusting conditions. The open sewer of the Fleet River passed by their windows. And more than 12 of their separatist brothers and sisters died there because of the conditions. But when the ecclesiastical authorities arranged conferences in the prison, attended by up to 42 ministers, with the aim of persuading Barrow and Greenwood to return to the Church of England, the pair relished the opportunity that this gave them to share their separatist views. And Barrow and Greenwood also used their time in prison to write letters, treatises, and petitions. These writings had to be smuggled out of prison sheet by sheet by sympathisers, and then they were printed abroad. And all of their works focused on what they called the four causes of separation from the Church of England. One, its false worship. Two, the mixed nature of its congregations. Three, its false and anti-Christian ministry. And four, its false and anti-Christian church government. And I've reproduced this in a handout, which you can have at the back if you want to see what they said. Another separatist leader, John Robinson, later insisted that even if there were no other cause for separation, the second one alone, the mixed nature of the Church of England, was sufficient to justify it. In spring 1593, legal proceedings against the London separatists intensified. Heading up the campaign was Archbishop Whitgift, whom Barrow had antagonised, and Richard Bancroft, a future archbishop who detested Puritans. On the 23rd of March 1593, Barrow and Greenwood were condemned to death for the offence of writing and publishing seditious literature with malicious intent. The following day, the prison jailers struck the fetters off both men. They were loaded onto a tumbril or cart and taken to Tyburn to be executed. However, they were reprieved at the last moment. They had friends in high places at Parliament and the court. A week later, they were carted off to Tyburn again. The nooses actually put round their necks this time, before being reprieved yet again and returned to prison. Finally, as the historian Patrick Collinson put it, it was third time unlucky. On the 6th of April, in circumstances of doubtful legality, said to be at the instigation of Whitgift himself, the pair were secretly taken from prison very early in the morning and finally hanged. They died steadfastly as martyrs for the separatist cause. And this is a memorial window to Barrow and Greenwood in Emmanuel United Reformed Church in Cambridge. The following month, the cause gained another martyr in the form of the Welshman John Penry, who had latterly been part of Barrow and Greenwood's church in London. And Penry died aged only 30, his death warrant signed by Whitgift. He left a young wife and four little daughters who were named Deliverance, Comfort, Safety, and Sure Hope. The eldest aged 4, the youngest only a few weeks old at the time of her father's death. We now move on to the 1590s to 1600s. We're going to look at Francis Johnson. Well, in July 1592, the year before his execution, John Greenwood was briefly released from prison, during which time a newly formed separatist congregation in London elected him, its teacher, and a man called Francis Johnson as its pastor. Francis Johnson, a Yorkshireman, was a contemporary of Arthur Hildersham at Cambridge University. And although Johnson had been ordained as a Church of England minister in Cambridge, he was expelled from the university in 1590 after preaching a sermon declaring that an eldership founded on the New Testament model was the only lawful form of church government. And Johnson fled to Middleburg, the place where Brown's church had been. And there he became minister of the English Merchant Adventurers Church, which was a non-separating congregation. And at this stage, Brown was still opposed to separatism. In fact, in spring 1591, when he heard that a banned volume of Barrow and Greenwood's works was in Holland, awaiting secret shipment to England, Johnson notified the English governor of Flushing, who seized the consignment of 4,000 books and had them burnt. However, Francis Johnson was curious. He kept one copy, he read it, and as a result was so convinced by its contents that he became a separatist. Gamekeeper turned poacher, you could say. Johnson couldn't persuade his current church to support his change of opinion, so in 1592 he returned to London to confer with Barrow and Greenwood. And that was how Johnson came to be elected as pastor of this new separatist church in London. They often met secretly in woods near Islington for fear of the authorities. But during one such meeting in March 1593, Johnson and 52 of his congregation, men and women, were arrested. As part of that same campaign against separatists that was to lead to the execution of Barrow and Greenwood the following month. And one of those arrested with Johnson was a 30-year-old purse maker, Thomas Hewitt from Swannington, near Ashby in Leicestershire. That's the Leicestershire mention. And frustratingly, we know nothing else about Hewitt except that he subsequently died for his beliefs in the Counter prison in Wood Street. And the Counter was a small but particularly foul prison. And it was destroyed in the Great Fire of London, 1666, and rebuilt. This is how it was after it was rebuilt. And that's where he died. Johnson himself spent more than 4 years in the Fleet prison, using his time to write for the separatist cause. He was hopeful of winning his old friend Arthur Hildersham to separatism. But if you've been to earlier lectures, you will know that he didn't succeed. And despite their disagreement, however, Johnson and Hildersham continued to regard each other as brethren in the Lord. But Francis Johnson was also becoming embroiled in controversies within his congregation, most of whom were in prison with him. In late 1594 or early 1595, Francis had married the widow of a wealthy draper from his congregation. And her proud manner and worldly style of dressing attracted much disapproval from church members, led by Johnson's own brother, George. Disputes rumbled on after the brothers were released from prison in 1597. The bulk of their previous congregation had already been exiled to Amsterdam when Francis and George finally joined them in September 1597. And their church became known as the Ancient Separatist Church of Amsterdam. However, despite lofty aspirations that the church might serve as a light upon a hill, dissensions multiplied. To the long-running quarrel with his brother was added other members' complaints about how Francis was ruling the church. Francis's father, John, travelled to Amsterdam in an effort to reconcile his two sons, but this only resulted in him too being excommunicated by Francis. In 1603, Francis Johnson visited England to petition the new king, James I, for tolerance for separatists, but was rebuffed. Returning to Holland, Johnson spent the years from 1603 to 1610 writing books denouncing the English church and advocating separatism. And Johnson's reputation amongst English radical Protestants was now at its height. One critic sarcastically labelled him the Bishop of Brownism. But these years also brought more troubles for Johnson. And the most serious of these began in 1607, when a new separatist group arrived in Amsterdam, led by a former pupil of Johnson's called John Smythe. More of this in a minute. The final years of Johnson's life were filled with strife and legal disputes. Johnson, with the followers who remained loyal to him, was forced to move to Emden between 1613 and 17. That's obviously a modern picture of Emden. Johnson eventually returned to Amsterdam in 1617, where he died, and on the 10th of January, 1618, was buried. The entry in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography on Johnson sums him up like this. He had a controversial character. He was a brave man, a learned polemicist, and an effective debater. But his shifting opinions, his intellectual pride, and passionate temperament made him an overbearing colleague, a difficult family member, and a divisive pastor. I don't think he would have put that epitaph on his tombstone. So we now come, finally, on our snapshot tour of early English separatism to the 1600s and the 1610s, in the form of John Smythe, or it may have been pronounced Smith, but I'll try and stick with Smythe. And it's unfortunate that there's been a clergyman called John Smythe who's been in the news recently concerning allegations of abuse. But the John Smythe that we're going to look at is a totally different man who lived 450 years earlier. And I want to include John Smythe partly because of his East Midlands connections, but especially because he latterly espoused a doctrine that so far hasn't featured in our story, the practice of believers' baptism. And so far, all of the English separatists that we've covered have had continued to accept the validity of infant baptism. Smythe was to reject this, with dramatic results, as we shall see. There had been Anabaptists, the name means re-baptizers, on the continent during the Reformation period, and a few in England in the 16th century. But nevertheless, Smythe played a significant role in establishing the doctrine of believers' baptism in England. Details of John Smythe's early life are shadowy. It's been suggested that he may have been born in a place called Sturton-le-Steeple in Nottinghamshire, which was the birthplace of another separatist leader, John Robinson, who is probably the character portrayed on the, what's that side, the left of the sign. But the name John Smythe or Smith is so common, it's hard to be sure. Similarly, the year of his birth isn't known. But as he went up to Cambridge University in 1586, it could have been around 1570, which is somewhat later than the date that I suggested in the original title for today's lecture. Smythe's tutor at Christ College was none other than Francis Johnson, prior to his expulsion from the university. Smythe was ordained as a Church of England minister sometime between 1584 and 1595. He was already moving in zealous Puritan circles. In 1597, Smythe was in trouble for refusing to wear the surplice and conform to the other ceremonies that Puritans objected to. And this led to him leaving his university fellowship in 1598. In September 1600, Smythe became town lecturer in Lincoln. But despite having the mayor's backing, Smythe's preaching soon made enemies who objected to his message and its application. The Bishop of Lincoln supported these complaints and withdrew Smythe's preaching license in 1602. And Smythe had to make a living by school teaching and practicing basic medicine. However, between 1604 and 1606, there were reports of Smythe preaching at Gainsborough in Lincolnshire, even without a license. By this time, he was married with two daughters, but their names are unknown. And when Smythe published his first book in 1605, he was still explicitly repudiating separatism. But it's clear that sometime late in 1605 or early 1606, that Smythe had come to a separatist understanding. He'd spent a lot of time discussing and thinking deeply about church issues. And about February 1607, after 9 months of hesitation, Smythe made his break from the Church of England. Shortly after, he could be found styling himself pastor of the church at Gainsborough. And by church, he meant a company of God's people freely joining themselves by covenant into a church. Gainsborough was a thriving market town and port at the time. And it's in that region of the Lower Trent Valley, covering parts of Lincolnshire, Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire, where separatism flourished. It's the area where the Pilgrim Fathers, who sailed for America in 1620, originated. And they, of course, were separatists, as we heard last time. And as well as Gainsborough, where Smythe ministered, the other main separatist centre in the region was Scrooby in North Nottinghamshire, where another church met under the spiritual leadership of John Robinson. And it was the normal practice of these churches to hold two Lord's Day services, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, each of 3 or 4 hours length, characterised by solemn prayer, and 4 or 5 speakers expounding the same text of Scripture, one after another. And as we've heard in previous lectures, demands for conformity to the national church increased after 1603, when James I came to the English throne. And this tightening of the net may have contributed to the feeling of the separatists that there was no place for them in England. And they hoped that by going overseas, they would escape persecution and find freedom to worship according to their convictions. And they knew all about the fate of those earlier separatists, Barrow and Greenwood. In 1607, an abortive attempt was made by a group of local separatists to flee to the continent, but they were apprehended near Boston. However, by 1608, John Smythe had moved to Amsterdam, and a group led by his fellow worker in Gainsborough, Thomas Helwys, succeeded in joining him after a difficult crossing of the North Sea. And the second group from Scrooby, under John Robinson and William Brewster, also emigrated to the Netherlands in 1608. An exile had been the penalty for holding Brownist conventicles since 1593, so emigration wasn't strictly illegal, although they did it without official permission or license, so it probably was for them. And once in Amsterdam, Smythe made contact with the ancient separatist church led by Francis Johnson and Henry Ainsworth, without actually joining it. And disagreements between Smythe and the ancient church soon emerged. The first dispute concerned the use of the scriptures in public worship. Smythe believed that the Bible was only inspired in the original languages in which it was written. So he objected to the reading of translations of the Bible in the services. Smythe said that church officials could bring with them the originals of Hebrew and Greek and out of them translate by voice, but that by reading them in translation impeded the working of the Holy Spirit. And on this ground, Smythe's followers broke off communion with Johnson's church and calling themselves the Brethren of the Separation of the Second English Church at Amsterdam. Another area of dispute between the two fellowships concerned church government. Johnson had come to believe that the discipline and government of the church should be exercised by the eldership, whereas Smythe emphasised the final authority of the congregation in all matters. And some of Johnson's church, including his assistant, Henry Ainsworth, were persuaded by Smythe's arguments and sided with him. Well, by spring 1609, John Robinson and William Brewster could bear the quarrelling no longer, and they moved with their own community to the industrial town of Leiden, where they remained until their relocation to the New World as the Mayflower Pilgrims. But the biggest controversy of all occurred around January 1609, when Smythe dissolved and reconstituted his church in Amsterdam. And in an act that deeply shocked his contemporaries, Smythe baptized himself. Then Thomas Helwys and the rest of his followers, by sprinkling water over their faces from a basin. I don't think he could have done it the other way, but baptism by immersion or dipping didn't become an issue until a little bit later. Smythe was pejoratively labelled the Say Baptist, or self-baptizer, as a result. And he took this action because he now accepted that the baptism of believers, rather than infants, was taught by the New Testament. For Smythe, too, the role of the Holy Spirit in baptism was crucial. Baptism, he wrote, is not just washing with water. It is baptism of the Spirit, the confession of the mouth, something that infants couldn't do, and the washing with water. You may wonder why some of the other separatists that we've looked at haven't considered believers' baptism too, because they were keen to return to a New Testament pattern. But the main reason that they didn't was that Anabaptism was forever associated in the minds of 16th century people with the notorious events that had occurred in the German city of Münster in 1534-5. A group of Anabaptists had set up their own kingdom, with their leader anointing himself as universal king of righteousness, imposing compulsory polygamy, and executing any who opposed him. All civic order was overthrown, and complete anarchy ensued. Ever since then, to be called an Anabaptist was the greatest form of abuse, and no one wanted to be linked with them or their doctrine. So the early separatists had shied away from the issue of baptism, even though it caused them problems when they tried to justify their own infant baptism at the hands of a church, the Church of England, that they now maintained was not a true church. But John Smythe did not hold back from confronting the issue, setting out his new views on baptism in a book entitled The Character of the Beast, in 1610. So why did Smythe baptise himself? Well, he defended his action by saying, there was no church to whom we could join with a good conscience to have baptism with them. In other words, baptism needed to be performed by a church which itself practised believers' baptism, and he didn't know any. However, his action attracted a storm of criticism. His detractors said that anyone could baptise himself and form a church of one, which was ridiculous. And, it was pointed out, there was a Dutch church in Amsterdam called the Waterlanders, who practised believers' baptism, and they traced their spiritual descent to the Anabaptists of the previous century. So, to satisfy his critics, Smythe made contact with the Waterlander congregation by the summer of 1609, and he came to believe that this was a true church and that he should have sought baptism from one of its ordained officers. Now, as a consequence, Smythe now felt that his self-baptism had been invalid and that a third baptism might be necessary. He applied to the Waterlanders for membership, drawing up 20 articles of faith to explain what he believed. And In addition to agreeing with them on the issue of baptism, these articles also show that by this stage, Smythe had rejected the orthodox Calvinist doctrines of original sin and double predestination and embraced a more Arminian position of general redemption. Jacob Arminius was currently expounding similar views in the Netherlands, so Smythe may have been influenced by him or by the stance of the Waterlanders themselves. Smythe also urged his followers to apply to the Waterlanders for rebaptism, but this was just a step too far for some of them, having so recently been baptized by Smythe. And it led to a split in the church, in which Smythe and 31 supporters were formally excommunicated by a minority led by Thomas Helwys. But the Amsterdam Waterlanders viewed Smythe's self-baptism less harshly than Smythe did himself, and they were keen to welcome the English into membership. But they belonged to a wider Mennonite fellowship, which wanted to satisfy itself on various counts before admitting these strange English folk. In the meantime, Smythe and his followers continued to meet an informal fellowship in a room at the back of a bakehouse. They lived in conditions of abject poverty as they waited for a decision from the Waterlanders. And they were finally admitted to membership in January 1615, after years of negotiations. But Smythe himself did not live to see it. For John Smythe, never a well man, fell ill in the summer of 1612, probably of TB, and died at the end of August. He wasn't much over 40 years of age. And Smythe was buried in the New Kirk in Amsterdam on the 1st of September, 1612. And in his final illness, Smythe reflected on his life and beliefs in one last book called The Retraction of His Errors and the Confirmation of the Truth. And his spirit seems to have softened as eternity approached. In this book, while affirming that he hadn't changed his mind about any of the things that he believed, Smythe confessed that he'd often addressed those who disagreed with him in too harsh a manner. He now retracted, quotes, all the biting and bitter words, phrases and speeches that he'd uttered in earlier controversies. He regretted his former course of censuring other persons, and especially for all those hard phrases wherewith I have in any of my writings inveighed against either England or the separation. He now admitted that there were zealous Christians within the established church, even if they misguidedly conformed to it. Smythe's desire was now, quotes, to end controversies amongst Christians rather than to make or maintain them, especially in matters of the outward church and ceremonies. And differences of opinion about the outward church would not cause him, quotes, to refuse the brotherhood of any penitent and faithful Christian whatsoever. And so ended the life of John Smythe on a more humble and gracious note. So finally, and very briefly, by way of conclusion, four lessons that I've learnt, really, from studying the lives of these early separatists. One, the privileges we enjoy today, such as the freedom to worship in gathered companies of believers, were hard won. Many of the separatists suffered greatly in foul London prisons because they refused to attend their parish church. Their desperate pleas for justice and relief went largely unheard. Francis Johnson wrote from prison in 1593 that he hoped he would soon be freed, but, quotes, if not, the will of God be done. I am assured there shall not a hair of our heads perish without God. And therefore, seeing by the mercy of God, we suffer for well-doing, we commit ourselves to him as to a faithful creator. Blessed be his name, who hath said, I will not leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, neither will I fear what man can do to me. It was a further 4 years before Johnson was released. Henry Barrow declared that, by the grace of God, he would affirm his commitment to the truth and, quotes, seal it with my blood also, if so God will. He died on the scaffold 16 days later. Secondly, faithfulness to biblical truth should be the foundation of everything that we do. But without the exercise of love and humility in our dealings with others, the most perfect church order counts for nothing. John Smythe realised this at the end of his life, writing that the contention for outward matters, which are of inferior note, hath broken the rules of love and charity, which is the superior law. Thirdly, value and work for the peace of the church. If we have peace in our church fellowships, we should prize it and never take it for granted. It can be so easily lost. Psalm 122, which we sang in Isaac Watts' version, exhorts us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Psalm 133 tells us how good and pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity, and that there the Lord commands the blessing, even life forevermore. And fourthly and finally, to worship God is our joyful privilege and blessing as believers. Robert Brown wrote that the Lord's people shall come willingly in the day of his assemblies. No man compels us to come. And as we prepare for worship each Lord's Day, the words of Isaac Watts that we sang should sum up our hearts. How pleased and blessed was I to hear the people cry, "Come, let us seek our God today." Yes, with a cheerful zeal, we haste to Zion's hill, and there our vows and honours pay.